In the matter of Kim Allen versus Cape May County, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Jennifer Barr with Cooper Levinson on behalf of defendants Cape May County and Gerald Thornton.
Good morning, Your Honor. Sebastian Iono from Iono and Higby for the plaintiff, Kim Allen.
Welcome, counsel. Ms. Barr, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, Honorable Associate Justices. May it please the court. And before I get started, I would like to reserve time for rebuttal at the end, if necessary.
That's fine.
Thank you. This is a conscientious Employee Protection Act claim by plaintiff Kim Allen against the defendants, Cape May County and Gerald Thornton. Plaintiff had been appointed to a three-year term by Gerald Thornton's predecessor. When Gerald Thornton came to the directorship, it was his decision to reappoint plaintiff or not. So he was the only decision maker who would have made that decision. And as the record shows, there were some issues with plaintiff's performance, even though Gerald Thornton did not need any reason at all to not renew her her position. He determined that she would not be renewed, that her term would not be renewed. Plaintiff has a theory that the termination was related to the whistleblowing activities as alleged in the complaint. But what plaintiff lacks are facts to back that up. Plaintiff essentially has to prove two essential points. Number one, she has to prove that Gerald Thornton was aware that there were whistleblowing activities as she alleges, because without his awareness of those activities, there could be no causal connection between the alleged whistleblowing activity and the adverse employment action. But the analysis doesn't stop there. Ultimately, she needs to prove that Gerald Thornton's decision was motivated by a retaliatory animus because of these whistleblowing activities. And the record is barren to support that claim. No reasonable jury on this record will be able to determine in plaintiff's favor. And why is that? Because of the ample evidence showing that she did, in fact, have performance issues. That is what motivated Gerald Thornton to not renew her term, even though he didn't need any reason at all. So essentially, our argument is the same as the dissenting opinion below by Judge Accurso. That opinion was thoroughly analyzed the evidence, it was well-reasoned, and for those same reasons, we are also arguing that a reasonable jury would not be able to determine that plaintiff satisfied her burden of proof for a CEPA claim. And therefore, we are requesting that this court reverse the majority opinion below and reinstate the trial court's order granting summary judgment for defendants. Now, that concludes my opening statement. Right out of the gate, though, I'd like to ask, is this connection okay?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes?
We can see
okay.
You. Please go ahead with okay. Please go ahead with your argument.
Thank you. I had some question during that opening statement. It did not appear to be so on my end. So anyway, I would like to start initially with the first point that plaintiff needs to prove, which is Gerald Thornton's knowledge and what he was aware of and what he knew and when he knew it. And I'd actually like to start in reverse order of what we briefed. I'd like to start with the Ballard Spahr contract only because something in the trial court's opinion made me flagged in my mind that I needed to really address the facts relating to the Ballard Spahr contract, because Gerald Thornton's knowledge of that contract could not have happened until after he decided to not renew plaintiff's term. And there were three events that happened with regard to the Ballard Spahr contract. The first was it was called a core meeting, which is essentially meetings of the department heads, no freeholders were at these meetings, or at least there's no evidence that freeholders were at this particular meeting. But that meeting was in April, and all that happened in that meeting was that the Bellage Spar contract was made aware of, the existence of it was known by plaintiff, and she asked a question, really, just about some of the terms in the contract. There's no evidence in the record that any of that information was relayed to Gerald Thornton. And there's no evidence that there were minutes or anything that could indicate that Thornton was aware in April that plaintiff had some issues with the Bellage Spar contract. But the next episode with the Bellage Spar contract was only between plaintiff and James Arsenal, who was county counsel, or actually I think he was assistant county counsel at that time.
Can I ask you a question, Ms. Barr,
sure.
Right off the outset? I've looked at the complaint. I cannot tell under what section of 34.19.3 plaintiff's theory of this action is being brought. Is it A? Is it C? If it's C, what part of C are we talking about? You know, was this something that was, maybe it's not so clear from the pleadings, but it was clearly understood between counsel as to how this evidence was coming in? Because typically, I mean, you know, under Dwosnar and some of our case law, we have to look very precisely at what it is plaintiff is expected to show. Can you illuminate that for me so I can understand better and contextualize your points with regard to this record?
Well, there is a problem with that because plaintiff has not identified with specificity which section she is making her claim for.
And the trial court never clarified that at all with counsel.
In all honesty, I was not the counsel for the summary judgment motion, nor was
as far as you know.
But as far as I know, it appeared that the court was analyzing this under subsection. I think
C.
It was C. That would be my guess. And I do know that Judge Accurso addressed this thoroughly because that was one of the issues that vexed her, in her opinion, was that it's
yes.
unclear section. But there was, it seems to be C, only because it was not, it just seemed that was the most fitting of all of the cases. But I would suggest
as,
that-
As plaintiff?
That
as
was,
plaintiff at any- At any point in the litigation, has plaintiff made it clear what part of the statute up until now?
Not to my knowledge, no. I don't think it was briefed.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Counsel,
please continue.
No. Counsel, can I direct you to what my concern is and so that you can respond to it based upon the summary judgment record? So Alan is a purchasing agent. Lindsay, the stepson of the freeholder director, was the director of human resources. There was a request for proposal for workers' comp. It could be on an hourly or a case basis. A law firm that Lindsay was familiar with comes back with an hourly. Then Lindsay goes to the purchasing agent, Alan, and says, can we swap it? So he, suggesting that he has a friend in the law firm. And Alan says, no, that would be illegal. Then Lindsay goes to someone else and says, can we swap it? And the person says, it's illegal. Okay, now Bellage Spar is conducting an investigation. And Alan speaks to Bellage Spar. And Alan tells Bellage Spar, in the redacted portion that we've gotten, that Lindsay, the stepson of the freehold director, was asking me to do this. He's a lawyer. He's asking me to swap it out. And, you know, this isn't legal. The Bellage Spar report is issued 1 month before Alan is fired. The freehold director, Thornton, says, I read the Bellage Spar. I read that report. So on the record before us, the summary judgment record, Thornton is reading a report where Alan is colloquially bad-mouthing his stepson and suggesting to this law firm that his stepson did something illegal, and then 1 month later, she gets fired. Now, okay, I'm just looking at the summary judgment record. I'm not saying who's right or wrong. I want to make that very, very clear. Why, on a summary judgment record, why isn't that enough to get to a jury so that a jury can decide for itself whether she was fired for bad performance or whether or not she was fired because the freehold director wasn't really taking kindly to the fact that his stepson was getting trashed by Allen in the official report given to the freeholders. Go with that.
Okay, so that is essentially the linchpin of plaintiff's claim, and that does go to what Gerald Thornton knew and when he knew it. But so what happened between Lindsay and plaintiff, he wasn't saying, and the evidence doesn't show that he said, I want to swap this. He asked the question of whether it was possible. And that's a marked difference because he was new. He had only been in that position as a director of human resources for, I think, 4 months at that time. And granted, he was an attorney, but did not have much background in direct dealings with public purchasing law. So he was asking a question about whether it was possible to do, and the evidence does not show that he said, I want to swap this page. The evidence just said he asked the question, and she told him that, no, you couldn't do that.
And you put that in the context of subsection C, if that is indeed the case, the section of the statute we're under? An employer shall not take any retaliatory action because the employee, et cetera, objects to or refuses to participate in any activity, policy, or practice which the employee reasonably believes is in violation of a law, et cetera. There's a lot of other language. There is no dispute, as I understand, and tell me if I'm wrong, that no steps were taken to do this swap, for lack of a better term, of lawyers. That all that happened, even according to plaintiff, was I was asked if this is okay, and I said it wasn't okay.
Correct.
And that's all we have. Is that right?
Yes. And she was the public. Her job was to know public purchasing law. And so her job was to let her colleagues know whether a certain action was in compliance.
But he was a lawyer too. She just has to have a reasonable belief. So if he's asking her, can I do this illegal thing? And then the question is, and then she's reporting it to Ballard Spahr that's conducting an investigation, it's whether or not the freeholder director is retaliating against her because she reported it. I mean, that's what the plaintiff is arguing. Am I correct?
Well, the evidence doesn't show he asked if he could do that. The evidence just said he asked if it was possible.
Okay.
She has to have
a belief that there is something being done that is illegal. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong. I don't see subsection C as saying that she has a reasonable belief that someone has asked a question as to whether something is legal or not. You would have calls to general's counsel in companies, is this okay, is that okay, and of course other people who have authority to tell, regulatory people and so forth, becoming SEPA claims if all that's necessary is to ask a question as to whether something's okay. Because as far as I read this record, this thing, whatever the swap was, never happened. No steps were taken to do it. It simply was a question. Am I missing something in the record?
That's our reading of the record, yes, that he simply asked a question. And our reading of the record is based on plaintiffs and Barbara Bakley Marino, who was the county counsel, who was standing there at the time this conversation between Lindsay and plaintiff took place. She was there too. And she also agreed that they both reported it to Ballard Spahr in this investigation. And they both said, he asked if he could do it, and we said, no, he couldn't. But what Marino did after that, which is relevant also, she made a comment, something like, our new human resources director doesn't know public purchasing law. And that also was part of the report.
It was just a question. So it was a question, okay, that the purchasing agent thought was for something illegal. But it's now in the ballot bar SPAR report. Thornton reads it. So my question to you is, did Thornton have a right to fire her? Did he have a right to fire her if he read the report and didn't like the fact that she reported the ballot SPAR? Would that be lawful?
If he interpreted that comment or that reporting to Ballard Spar as whistleblowing and not something else, then that
let's take it as something else. He didn't like the fact that, just the way Justice Patterson put it, it was a question, can I do this thing that would be illegal, but it's just the question. But
so that just to be clear, that's not the question that was asked.
Okay,
but he's saying, can I do something illegal?
Can he fire him? Just based upon how she reported it, the ballot bar, that had been lawful.
Thornton could have
do that. I've got to kill a bee.
Oh.
is that purely
go ahead.
Speculative? Purely skeptical. Go ahead. I thought you had finished your answer. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, so Joe Thornton, first of all, this is not a termination question. It's a not renewing a term that already had expired or was about ready to expire. And it's a political appointment. So the question is whether there's evidence that he read the report at some point. He says he doesn't remember reading anything about what plaintiff said in the report because the report is 40 some pages long. Her section takes up a couple lines, but I'm going to circle back to the purpose of the report. But
let me ask you a question first, ma'am. Just quick. Is it sufficient for purpose of beating summary judgment speculation that this might have happened because they were related? Do you need, is that competent evidence for a court to consider and grant or deny summary judgment?
That is one thing that I think that the majority opinion should not have commented on. I think their comment was, in their opinion, that it cannot be ignored that there was a family relationship, but it has to be ignored because there's nothing in the record that would show that relationship between an adult man, Jeff Lindsay, and his stepfather. There's nothing in the record that would show that would make any difference here. It's just a relationship. That's not a factor to consider here without anything else, without anything that showed that there was a close family relationship there, or that they were particularly close as stepfather and stepson. I mean, they were adults. They were colleagues.
Even if they were close, is that sufficient to survive summary judgment? Even if they loved one another very much, even if they had dinner at their house every week, without more, is it sufficient to defeat a summary judgment motion?
If there was evidence in the record to suggest that, then that would be an inference on top of another inference that was the motivating factor, or that was a part of what Gerald Thornton was considering to the point where it was the determinative factor in his decision to not. But standing alone, it's not standing alone because there were other reasons. There were plenty of other reasons why Thornton decided to term to not.
But aren't we? Aren't we really? Doesn't this case have some difficulty when it comes to even making the threshold showing that the plaintiff objected to or refuses to participate in any activity, policy, or practice which she reasonably believes was illegal, et cetera, and of course all the different language that the statute has, when we don't have a question asked, can I do something illegal? We have a question asked, can we do this action? Told by the general counsel, no. Told by the purchasing, the head of purchasing, no. And it appears that was the end of that. There's no indication that this individual did anything other than take the advice of the lawyer he's supposed to take the advice of and back off. I mean, isn't that really the record here?
And there was a follow-up email between plaintiff and Jeff Lindsay, head of human services, where she said, well, I'm not going to go into the details, but she kind of gave a follow-up and said, this is what you could do, and we could just pull the contract all together and then rebid it. I mean, it's in the record. Right. There was a follow-up.
Following up on Justice Patterson's point, how does the insertion of those couple of lines in the Ballard report, which is happening well after the initial exchange and well after the RFP for the workers' comp contract has already been awarded, how does that fit under 19.3C? She's not objecting to something or refusing to participate in something because it's already taken place. So I don't understand how anything reported to Ballard fits under C. Maybe it could fit under A, but I don't even see how it fits under A.
Before you answer the question.
What is she disclosing?
I want to ask everybody to mute if you're not asking questions, please.
So please come. Does the Ballard report even fit under a C analysis?
Judge Accurso actually addressed this, and she thought that Ballard Spar, the reporting to Ballard Spar, was arguably under C1 because that would only work if the Ballard Spar investigators could be considered some kind of an agent of the freeholders. But I would like to...
Come back to my question. Objects means you're stopping something as it's happening. This mm-hmm. Ballard report is happening how many months. After a contract has already been awarded? There's a disconnect here that is not being addressed either in the majority or the dissenting opinions.
And that goes to causation, because that couldn't have, I mean, the initial question in February, I mean, there's no evidence that Thornton was ever aware that happened at the time. So the only way he could have known about that is through this Ballard Spar report. Okay. And you're right, it is not clear what section that falls under, because the investigators aren't asking plaintiff to do anything. So is it a question that she's reporting? And the investigators were not a public body, so she's not...
That's correct. So I don't see how it fits under A either.
So that goes to whether...
So what's left if the Ballard... Let's assume the Ballard report can't fit under A or C. What is left to support a whistleblowing claim?
According to us, not much at all, because the third whistleblowing activity, again, we're dealing with Ballard Spar again, but their contract and the bidding process of the contract, there's no evidence that Thornton was aware of that before he decided not to terminate, because the email directed to Thornton from plaintiff happened 2 days after.
That's the award of the contract to Ballard that you are referring to.
It's actually the bidding process. Plaintiff objected to the bidding process. She had that conversation with Arsenal about the language, the non-fair, non-open.
But that took place after.
And that took place after he decided. So what's left is a question asked in February to the purchasing agent, whose job it was to know whether something was compliant or not, and then a report of something that happened, that same event that happened months before, to the investigators. But I would like to discuss the report.
Plaintiff's position is, of course, she's only asking. Lindsay can only ask a question. He can't do the swap without the purchasing agent agreeing. So he goes to the purchasing agent, Alan, he goes to someone else, and they both say, no, And you're like, you're a lawyer. But now, and if they went along with that, if they said, yeah, it's okay, that would have been a violation of law. That would have been incompatible with public policy. And the gist of their complaint is, she now tells Ballard Spahr this. She says, I told Ballard Spahr this, and that's the stepson, and then the stepfather winds up firing me. And she says, I think that's enough for me to get to a jury. If the jury doesn't believe that that was the real reason for my firing, then let the jury decide that.
But that's not the end of the analysis, because what has to factor in are all of the other reasons that Gerald Thornton terminated her for. And we have a list of people who complained about her.
I understand. No one's saying that a jury has to believe the plaintiff. A jury can believe that she was fired for good cause because she was a troublemaker or whatever. Or the jury can say that the primary motivating factor was, you know, you went after one of my family members, I'm getting rid of you. Why isn't that not a jury issue?
Because a jury would have to find that that report to Ballard Spahr caused a retaliatory animus above that would be the reason that Thornton did not reappoint her. Something that happened all the way back in February.
We're not talking about some common law claim here. We're talking about SEPA. So there must be something that's within A or C under SEPA, and apparently this is a C case, so we'll look at C. And all we have here, you know, you could say, oh, some different things could have happened and maybe they told him it would be okay and they'd do something illegal. But she is unequivocal that nothing ever happened other than the no answer that he got from two people. And then she follows up, as you pointed out, and says, here's what we could do. Presumably she's giving him the legal options, and that this illegal practice or event never occurred and went no further. So doesn't that put a brake on this before you even get to the causation aspect of it?
I mean, definitely. We agree with that statement entirely. And that's one of the problems, like I said before, of not knowing which part of the SEPA statute we're in makes this analysis difficult.
Can I give you just a very simple hypothetical to see what your take is on this? It'll be like a historical. Richard Nixon asks the commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service, can you audit one of my political rivals' tax returns? Just ask the question. And then the IRS director says no, and then reports it to whomever, let's say to the – and Richard Nixon – fires him as a result of that. Would that be a SEPA action?
Well, I think whether that was whistleblowing or not, that's a little more of a clear example, because people know that you're not supposed to, you know, get tax information.
He just asked the question. Can you do this? Just the question. That's all.
I mean, I think if he honestly didn't know the answer to that question, which is implausible, if you ask me, and he's asking a question if something can be done to the person who is the one responsible for or in charge of knowing that or not, and then so, without anything else, but if there was nothing else at all, in the person's record or work record who answered that question, no, we can't do that, you know, give you the tax records. If there was absolutely nothing else, then that could be an issue there, yes.
So the hypothetical underscores that a question can be entirely legitimate or it can be loaded. What's reasonable to infer at the summary judgment stage when we have to look at the evidence in a light most favorable to plaintiff here?
Well, we still have to focus on what is in the record. And And that is where plaintiff fails here, because the record doesn't show that we'll do another hypothetical. Even if Thornton not only read the report, but took specific note of that language about Kim Allen reporting to the Ballard Spahr investigators, even if that were, even if the jury found that that was what happened, the analysis doesn't end there. She still has to show that it's that pretext is involved, that there was a retaliatory animus. And that alone doesn't show that reporting to Ballard Spahr alone doesn't show that that was the motivating factor here, because plaintiff doesn't have anything beyond the fact that that happened to show that he took that information and was he was inflamed by it to the point where he would decide not to renew her contract or her term.
So if I understand you correctly, you're suggesting that even if this is utterly inappropriate to have been posed as a question, if we were to assume that, you still prevail.
The question by Jeff Lindsay?
Yes.
I,
on the record in front of us, for the other reasons, your position is that you would still prevail.
Well, our contention is that the question itself is not, doesn't
no,
create
no, no.
any problems. But
yes, but assume the opposite. You say that that wouldn't and shouldn't affect the outcome of the case.
If Jeff Lindsay's question was, I want to illegally swap this page, and if she reported that, then that would be more of a traditional whistleblowing claim. But the analysis wouldn't stop there. It still would have to consider that. That's really just an issue of causation. You know, did the whistleblowing activity cause a adverse employment action? But it's not just that.
I think that's exactly what the chief just asked you. Hold on. I think that's exactly what the chief just asked you. If assuming that he was saying do something illegal, but you're saying there's no evidence of any retaliatory animus as a result of that, you would still win. Is that your contention?
Yes.
It should still be summary judgment because there's no evidence of retaliatory action, animus, and therefore there's no causation. So you're entitled to summary judgment.
Essentially, yes.
Okay. I think that's all the chief was trying to get at.
Okay.
Can I ask you a question, counsel, Ms. Barr?
Yes.
What precisely was the investigatory charge to Ballard Spahr?
Thank you for bringing that up, because that is something I wanted to address. And this is something that Judge Accurso actually does bring up in her opinion. And it is, it's kind of, it's sort of a long story. I'm going to try to streamline it, but Barbara
didn't it
Baker,
originate with a complaint filed by Ms. Marino?
Yes, it did.
Okay.
And actually not a complaint. She had some issue because she mm-hmm. was the county counsel, but she had been the human resources director. And just for the record, when she was county counsel, or when she first started her employment with Cape May County, her father was the freeholder. But for some reason, she saw, or she, I don't know if she learned, but her issues were that what Jeff Lindsay was making as human resources director and what she made while she was human resources director were not the same. And so her issue was that there were some unequal pay going on. And so that was, and she had, it was much more than that, but that was essentially an LAD claim, which prompted this investigation, this quick investigation too, because they wanted, you know, that the LAD requires that. And it's in that context though, that the whole investigation, the report was about these, you know, these unequal pay issues and some other issues like that, which brings me back to the reporting by both Marino and Kim Allen to the Ballard's Bar investigators, whether that they could have been showing to the investigators that Jeff Lindsay doesn't know public purchasing law. That's exactly what Barbara Bakley Marino said, which would impact any kind of investigation into pay disparity. If he didn't know public purchasing law, maybe he shouldn't have been paid whatever he was being paid in relation to. Maybe she knows more about public purchasing law.
But I thought she was complaining about, in addition, nepotism. She said, you know what? I had the same position that the son-in-law of the freehold director held, and I made less money. And I'm trying to figure out, like, why I made less money. And so nepotism and Lindsay wound up being the focal point of Marino's complaints and also part of Allen's complaints, too. Am I mistaken about that?
Marino's issues. I mean, you can't really say that they're complaints because she didn't file. I mean, and it wasn't agreed. It was just her own issues. But the idea of nepotism is it's about whether somebody is hired or not. Or I mean, it's not an issue that would play out here, because we're not talking about doing any favors for somebody because of the family relationship. That might have been what Barbara Marino was suggesting, but that idea of nepotism isn't relevant here. But yes, to answer the question, that was one of the things that she had an issue with. But there's I honestly just don't recall in the record whether it was ever expounded upon as to what that nepotism issue that Marino had involved. Was it the pay disparity, or was it something else? We just don't know.
You mentioned retaliatory animus. Is it fair to say that in most SEPA claims, retaliatory animus is proved by inferences? No one's expecting the target of a SEPA action, like the freeholder director here, to say, hey, I had a retaliatory animus to against Allen. I'm fine. I want you to know I fired her because she badmouthed my stepson. Those scenarios don't occur. There are inferences that are drawn, and most of the time they're left to the jury to decide whether it's an acceptable inference or it's an unacceptable inference. Am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor, you are, but the inferences cannot be based on speculation. They have to be based on facts in the record. And if the only inference about retaliatory animus has to do with the family relation, that's pure speculation, because there's nothing in the record that shows that they were particularly close or not. And that would be impermissible to allow a jury to speculate just on that, because there is nothing else in the record that would show that the retaliatory animus came from anything other than this knowledge of her reporting to Ballard Spahr.
So was Ballard Spahr, did Ballard Spahr interview Ms. Allen as part of their investigation?
She asked to be interviewed, or she asked.
Okay, so she initiated it. They did not ask to interview her.
Okay. She did initiate, yes.
So would that then fall under A, 3A?
If I were to have to choose, like, if I were plaintiff here, I would have chosen that, yes. That was
okay.
More in the Section
so
A.
So that would be disclosure to, I guess, a public body of a violation of law or rule or regulation, right?
Except for that the investigators were not a public body.
I'm struggling to fit them in under that too, but I'm trying to see how reporting to Ballard Spahr in the context of their charge, however they ended up interviewing her at her initiation, falls under A or C.
Right. And
can you please address that?
If you
don't see it, please tell me.
I don't see it. It certainly is not under C, because the Ballard Spahr investigators are not asking, or there's just no requesting that the plaintiff engage in any kind of illegal activity. So if it is going to fall under any subsection, it would have to be A. And the only way it would is if the Ballard's Bar investigators, because they are not a public body, whether they were somehow, because they were retained by county council on behalf of the freeholders. But it's a stretch. I mean, it is definitely a stretch. And without a firm
isn't the freeholder board the public body, and Ballard Bar is the agent. They're reporting to the public body. So I mean, if you were looking at A, and I'm not talking about whether A is applicable or not, but the appropriate public body would be the freeholder board. Now, on behalf of which Ballard Bar is acting by conducting this investigation. Am I correct?
I mean, that could be their argument, yes.
Is that who hired them?
They were commissioned by the county council, who technically
acted on behalf of the county board of freeholders.
Freeholders, yes.
And is is there any nexus? It was interesting you mentioned that there was some suggestion in the Marino, you said issues, whatever they may have been, that this individual was not knowledgeable about public finance law, right, or public purchasing law. So when they discussed this at her initiation, was there some relevance to their investigation in the sense that she is saying, well, he asked a question that nobody in their, you know, nobody would ask if they were familiar with the law. Is that somehow the nexus between this Marino investigation and what she is saying?
I'm sorry. I don't understand. I didn't follow that question.
They're investigating these Marino allegations or whatever they may be. And you indicated one of the issues there was whether this individual was knowledgeable about public the law that he would need to be knowledgeable about to be the HR director. So was there context of this discussion between Ballard Spar and Allen, his ignorance, for lack of a better word, about law, he asked a question that he shouldn't know the answer to. Was that essentially the discussion?
Well, we don't have, we don't have a clear, it's not clear on the record exactly what was the reason or the relationship between Marino's comment that he doesn't know public purchasing law and plaintiffs deciding to talk to the investigators. So that would be a legitimate inference, I would suggest, that the if you're investigating pay disparity, and assuming one of those issues would be qualifications, I mean, that certainly would be relevant to the qualifications.
In which case, the context of what she's saying is he didn't know he didn't know the material he was supposed to know. He was demanding an illegal activity. It was he asked a silly question that he should know better, you know, if he's in this position. And so aren't we then further afield from a SEPA claim, especially a subsection C SEPA claim, where the issue is reporting on an illegal activity?
Exactly. And that's the whole problem here, is that reporting Jeff Lindsay asking a question about whether something could be done is
what Justice Patterson said is one fair inference. The other inference that the plaintiff is making is that he's a lawyer and he's just trying to swap basically his friend's law firm bid in to get it in. That's what he's trying to do. It's not necessarily something where he's not knowledgeable about. He's trying to get a leg up for someone who he wants to help. That's why isn't that also a fair inference? Not that Justice Patterson's take isn't one. Why isn't the opposite not a fair inference?
I believe that the evidence doesn't say anything other than that Jeff Lindsay preferred this law firm. I don't think it was necessarily, he wants his buddy's firm to get a leg up here. But that a fair reading of the evidence is that he just was wondering whether that could be done.
Well, it also suggests that he had communication with that law firm. They put in a bid. So that's typically the end of the matter. So the record suggests that there was more communication between this law firm and Lindsay. No?
I don't recall seeing anything of that sort. My understanding was that Lindsay, and again, I honestly just don't know, but I think that he was looking through the bids and he saw that it was Capehart Skagit, that's how you pronounce it. It was just a firm that he admired or liked, or I forget what the term was that he used, but he just saw that was a good firm, and he saw that the bid wasn't listed, or the per hour quota was not there, or the other one, I can't remember which one it was, but it was just that he wanted to complete this bid so that the firm that he thought would be good for the job would have a fair shot.
Ms. Bark, we've been at it for considerably more than a half hour at this point. It might be helpful to hear Mr. Iono's answers to some of the questions, and we'd have you back later. Is there anything you wanted to crisply add before we stop here?
I believe everything that I wanted to get through, I did.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Mr. Iono.
Thank you, Chief Justice, Associate Justices. May it please the Court. The majority here hit the nail on the head when they made the Pinocchio to Jiminy Cricket reference. Miss Allen was the conscience of the Cape May County taxpayers. The only difference between Kim and Jiminy Cricket is that unlike Jiminy Cricket, who was bludgeoned, Miss Allen was fired from her job, eliminating her as the voice of the taxpayers for Cape May County. We're here on a motion for summary judgment, and the plaintiff is supposed to get the benefit of all reasonable inferences. I agree that if at this stage we gave the defense the benefit of all reasonable inferences, that summary judgment would be appropriate. But here, the plaintiff is entitled to those inferences. The court asked a lot of questions about the Jeff Lindsay workers' comp issue, so I want to start talking about that. This wasn't just a question by Mr. Lindsay. He first went up to my client and indicated that his favored firm, who had submitted a workers' comp bid, wanted to supplement their proposal, or could the county negotiate a per-case quote. The record is clear that at that point my client said no. He then went back up to her after the meeting and wanted to know if the vendor could fax a new proposal page to him. And it was at that point that Miss Allen advised him that what he wanted to do was illegal. And this was done in front of Barb Bakley Marino. But it didn't stop there. He then had a conversation with the former purchasing agent and asked him whether this could be done, whether he could switch out the faxed page and put that into the bid. And he also told him no, that it was illegal. So this wasn't just a simple question. This was something that Mr. Lindsay did on three separate occasions. And I think, Justice Albin, the question or the hypothetical you gave was similar to a hypothetical that I had. My firm here is a small firm. It's me, my partner, Ms. Higby, is also my wife, and we have an associate. If my partner had gone up to our associate and said, I really like client X, and there's certain documents in discovery that are just going to kill the case, is there any way we could claim privilege or not produce them? As my associate said, no, they're relevant, we have to. And then she said to him, you know, can we just redact some of it, just the really bad stuff? And he's like, no, I understand why you want to do that, but that's illegal. If my partner then went to the paralegal, tried to have her do the same thing, and then 3 weeks later, my associate is terminated and there's no other cause, to me, he would have a SEPA case. And that's similar to what happened here, because I think you have to look at the power dynamic. There's been an issue raised.
Could you tell me where in the record it says that the Lindsay went to your client and said, Cape Burns Cash is my preferred firm? Because I looked at the entire record before, I might have missed it. But could you tell me where that is actually anywhere in the record that he said, that's my preferred law firm? Because what I remember reading from the records, he said they'd like to supplement the bid. But I remember seeing anything about this is my preferred law firm. I want these people to get the assignment, anything like that. Can you tell me where in the record that is?
Justice Fernandez Vina, I don't have that specific citation. I just have that in my notes that this was his preferred or favorite firm.
Your client was asked at her deposition. So when you say he did something illegally, what did he do illegally? That's your testimony under oath. Answer, he asked me a question he shouldn't have asked. And then she went on to confirm that nothing was ever done. So she's characterizing her claim here as asking a question he shouldn't have asked. Now, the questions you hypothesized about your law firm, which I'm sure would never even happen, are directions to a subordinate that very strongly suggests this is what I want you to do. The questions, even under the plaintiff's version here, are questions about, is this okay? I'm coming to you for advice. And yes, he asked this person or that person the same advice. Yes, the general counsel told him no, your client told him no, and the former purchasing agent told him no. But the fact is, you are predicating your SEPA claim on someone asking a question whether a practice is legal or not legal. And if your SEPA claim can be premised on that, then people cannot ask questions of people who give them legal advice without risking SEPA claims. Now, that's not reflected in the statute, and I would respectfully suggest that it's not helpful policy to read that into the statute. Your client, it's not that anybody's, Judge Accurso or anybody is somehow characterizing your client. Your client said, my claim is he asked a question he shouldn't have asked. Not that he did anything, but he asked a question he shouldn't have asked. So where in SEPA is asking a question about the legality of an activity actionable? Which subsection is it? Where's the language?
Justice Patterson, this was more than a question. I understand that you're citing a specific portion of my client's deposition, but at other points in her deposition, she testified that what Lindsay asked her wasn't a question. It was a course of action that he wanted, and that was her interpretation.
She has asked, respectfully, she said, when you say he did something illegally, what did he do illegally? And she says, he asked a question he shouldn't have asked. That's her testimony. So are you saying that's enough? And if you're saying that's enough, what's subsection in SEPA makes that a whistleblowing activity, her reporting of that?
I'm not asking this court to expand SEPA. I'm not saying that just simply asking a question for informational purposes would create a cause of action under SEPA. I would agree with the court on that. Our position here is that if the court looks at the totality of the circumstances here, the fact that this wasn't just a simple question. If Mr. Lindsay just said, is this possible? My client said no, and it was over. Then at that point, Justice, I would agree that's probably not a SEPA case, but that's not what we have here.
You can't get second opinions from counsel? Counsel, it's improper. It's a violation to obtain a second opinion from actual counsel rather than the purchasing agent. That's what makes this illegal?
He went back up to my client again. County counsel just happened to be there, Justice. This wasn't Mr. Lindsay. My understanding wasn't Mr. Lindsay going up to Ms. Bakley Marino, but rather him going to my client saying, well, we couldn't do that. Can we have them fax a new proposal page? So,
again, it's a question about, can we legally do something? And again, you can ask two questions or five questions, but they're all questions seeking advice as to whether something is legal under your client's characterization of them, not under some defense characterization of them. So where are we in SEPA that gives reporting that someone asked a question about the legality of a practice that expands SEPA to include that?
Well, I think, Justice Patterson, if you're giving the defense the benefit of all reasonable inferences.
No,
if
no,
you're
sir,
inferring that this
I'm
is
not.
Just a question.
I'm not. She said it's a question. It's her
but my
characterization
client also,
of it.
She also testified, Justice, that this was a course of conduct that Mr. Lindsay wanted her to engage in. And I think if you look at the repeated attempts by him to supplement this bid, it shows that this wasn't just, can we do this? This is something that I want done, and I'm going to, and you need to do it. Even though he didn't use those words, that's what the intent was. And I think it's important, his relationship to the freeholder director here, when you look at that, at the overall dynamic, the court saying there's no evidence that they have a close relationship. He was hired as the human resources director at the same county that his stepfather is the freeholder director. He's given one of the few departmental heads in the county. He's one of the highest members of upper management. I think that's an inference that the court can take, that there is a close familial relationship here. It's not as if they're working at different businesses.
Mr. Iona, what yes, section sir. Of SEPA are you relying on?
So for the workers' comp, we are relying on Section C. And I understand that this was not...
When was that first made clear?
Your Honor, I cannot answer that question in that I was not at the trial court. I did not represent this below. And the trial court had ruled in the plaintiff's favor when it came to protected conduct. So the focus of our appeal brief was the only issue that the trial court ruled against us on, which was causation.
Is this the first time to your knowledge that it was made clear?
To my knowledge, but I did not review the oral argument before the trial court before
Understood.
This. And when I reviewed Judge Gibson's decision, I think he did in passing cite sections of SEPA, but I don't believe there was a deep analysis that discussed the specific sections that her protected conduct would fall under.
Are you familiar with our decision in Chiofalo? And did this case get tried before or after that decision came down?
Is that the state trooper case, Justice?
Yes. Yes.
I believe the decision in the appellate division came out sometime in 2018, and this court's decision in that case came out, I thought it was 2019.
Okay, I'll check the dates.
Because I did briefly review that mm-hmm. case, I was watching the oral argument yesterday.
This appellate division opinion came out in July 2019.
The appellate division came out 2019?
On this case, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think it's 2018, Justice.
2019.
So, Mr. Okay. Iono, I just need to ask the question, even though we're not, the appellate division issue was focused on causation, we need to look at causation in the context of the statutory language. So with respect to the workers' comp issue, and I guess that you're referring to the exchange of the between Mr. Lindsay and your client, the back and forth, and then the asking of other people a similar question. That's what you're referring to when you say the workers' comp issue?
That's correct. The bid for the workers' comp work.
Okay. So to whom, for safe purposes, did she object?
My client objected directly to Jeffrey Lindsay at the time that she had the two conversations with him, and also objected in the presence of county counsel, who agreed with my client's take.
So that's how you feel you're satisfying protected, that's the position for protected conduct.
She's refusing to participate in an activity which she believes violates the law.
When a lawyer for a company is asked, this, can we do this, which happens in small, medium, and large businesses every day, thousands of times, and the lawyer says no, has the lawyer just created for him or herself a SEPA claim by saying no? Are you saying that's the equivalent of objecting to a practice?
Well, first of all, there would absolutely not be a SEPA claim there, Justice, because just because you engage in protected conduct doesn't mean you're protected under SEPA. You would still have to suffer an adverse employment action
Understood.
And show that it's
Understood.
Causally connected.
Okay. then let's add that to the hypothetical. There's some sort of adverse claim. When a lawyer says, and lawyers can no doubt document who are in the business of advising businesses, day after day they are saying no. They're saying no, got to do it this way, got to do it that way, can't do it the way you want. Happens all that you're saying that is the equivalent of an employee objecting to an illegal practice.
Well, first of all, my client isn't a lawyer, and she's not providing advice to a client. So what I would say, I think it would depend, Justice. I think there's times where, if you look at the totality of the circumstances, where that question is more of a way you want the person to operate, a course of action, as opposed to, hey, I'm not sure what the law is here. Is this legal? So if it was as you described, we would like to do X, is this okay? The lawyer says no, it would violate the law. Then I would say that's probably not protected conduct.
It depends upon what X is. If a lawyer says to another partner, hey, can we borrow the client's money without advising the client? And then he says no, he wants to be getting fired for that, at least by his claim. That'd be problematic, wouldn't it? So it all depends upon what the question is and what the parties happen to know among themselves about the propriety of the question and what the response might be.
I agree, Justice Alvin. You put that much better than I did.
Okay, so with regard to that, now the next step of making this known, your argument is, I take it, this was disclosed through the Ballard report, correct? Because it had to be, C doesn't end with the exchange with Mr. Lindsay. There has to be a report to someone, correct?
Well, I think with the exchange with Mr. Lindsay is her refusal to participate in illegal activity, and that in of itself is protected conduct. I think the Ballard SPAR report helps us demonstrate that Freeholder Director Jerry Thornton was aware of this instance of prior protected conduct on behalf of my client, because there's
So do you take the position that the report prepared by Ballard SPAR satisfies the disclosure requirement in 19-4? 19-4 is the disclosure to public body or their representative, and it's a requirement of notice and opportunity in written form by the employee.
And I believe that Ballard SPAR, being an extension of the Freeholder Board and their agent, constitutes a public body.
But 19-4 is contemplating written notice by the employee.
Well, did she provide written notice to Mr. Thornton of this? No. Did she provide written notice on some of these issues to Mr. Lindsay? Yes. She did not provide anything in writing that I'm aware of to Ballard SPAR.
And when you say she provided written notice to Lindsay, she writes him an email saying, here's what we can do, right?
Correct, Justice. And then after that is when the conversation occurs about substituting a faxed page into the bid.
Right. And at which point she says, nope, can't do that either.
Well, I believe she said it was illegal at that point. Flat out said that.
And just to be clear, was it done?
You're correct, Justice. It was not done, but that does not come into the elements of SEPA. Just because the illegal conduct did not occur doesn't mean that the plaintiff can't satisfy a SEPA claim. That could be one of the factors a jury could decide when determining if there's causation ultimately. But as the court knows, even if my client was wrong on her objection, as long as her belief was reasonable, that's enough. So it doesn't matter if the employer actually then went forward and engaged in the illegal conduct. Like I said, it may be relevant when we're dealing with causation.
What is the evidence, if any, that she felt she was being asked to do something illegal? And I understand you say Lindsay, I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but I know you said Lindsay asked her a couple of times. And apparently, he didn't ask her about swapping out the page until she said we could rebid the contract. Correct?
That's correct. I think if you look at the sequence of events, Justice, that's...
Hold on. Don't get there. I heard that before. What is the evidence? The circumstances you're talking about, I get. When she was asked to testify about all of these things that happened, was she ever asked, or did she never ever answer that she was she ever asked? Did she feel pressured? Did she ever answer that she felt pressured? Did she ever say, "I thought I was being asked to do something illegal," or did she simply say, "He asked me if I could swap it out, and I said no. I told him it was illegal."
She testified that she did not view it as a question, but as a course of conduct. That was her testimony at her deposition, Justice.
Okay.
And so that was the under, and again, we're looking at her reasonable belief.
No, I get that. I'm just wondering when it was expressed, and in what way it was expressed. And you're saying that statement is how it was expressed. Her reasonable belief.
Yeah, as to being requested to do something illegal.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yes.
Let me ask.
But now the contract went to that firm. So how does your client show that her refusal to amend the bid documents in any way justifies a whistleblower complaint? I feel like there's a gap in the dots that you're asking us to follow along here.
Sure, and I'll explain that. And I hate to go back to Pinocchio and Jiminy Cricket, but Pinocchio didn't always listen to Jiminy Cricket, and he didn't kill him every time. Here, it became clear over a course of conduct that my client was going to make sure that the county was going to comply with public contract law. And once that was known, they wanted her gone. So even though it didn't affect this situation, if
your
she's
claim
removed,
is now that there was a conspiracy not to file contract law at the county, and it was an overarching conspiracy, and that's why she was fired. Is that what I'm understanding your example to give now?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that one of the factors, because all it needs to be is a motivating factor in Mr. Thornton's mind, was that my client brought objections forward dealing with his stepson and his wife, and that factored in his decision to ultimately non-renew her.
Your client but ultimately
the objection
recommended.
Has to be Chief.
Following up on Justice Sobecki's earlier question, your client ultimately recommended that the firm get this as well. How does that factor in?
Well, I don't know if it really matters, Chief Justice, because it's not what ultimately happened. It's whether she did refuse to participate in something she reasonably believed to be illegal. The fact that ultimately the law firm that Mr. Lindsay thought was the best ultimately received the bid is of no moment, because there's no requirement under the statute that the objection prevents something from occurring.
Am I mistaken? Did your client ultimately recommend this firm? Am I mistaken?
No, she did. She did, Chief Justice. I take your
position is it's not that the law firm got it. Is that she later complained to Ballard Spahr about what she thought was an unlawful proposal that the Freeholder director read the report, this is your argument at least, and fired her on the basis of reporting it to Ballard Spahr. Am I mistaken about your theory?
No, that's correct. And that was one of the things that troubled me with the appellate division's dissent, is that essentially my client was being criticized for following the letter of the law. There was a quote that Ms. Bakley Marino made at a deposition that my client to follow the letter of contract law would allow everyone to die. My client's job as the purchasing agent is to make sure that taxpayer money is being spent properly. So she was, it wasn't the outcome that she was concerned with. It was the process and making sure that the county followed a legal process. Once that process was legal, she concurred and agreed that this was the best firm for the county and ultimately agreed, and that's the firm that was hired. But the process is important here. We need to have public trust in what our governments are doing and who they're hiring. And we need people like Ms. Allen to come out and voice those objections.
I don't think there's any question of criticism of your client. I mean, the issue before the court is whether she has, whether not on a motion to dismiss, where all factual inferences are in her favor, but on a summary judgment record, where she is entitled to inferences, but we have a full factual record, has she stated a SEPA claim when she has predicated, in her own words, a SEPA claim on a question being asked that should, in her mind, should not have been asked? And that's what we're here about. Not any, you know, criticism of her performance, but the question is whether she has provided facts as limited by her own testimony at several key points that are sufficient to withstand summary judgment.
I agree. And going back to that one issue, she did testify, as Your Honor stated, but later in her deposition, when asked a question, did she think it was a question or a course of conduct? She stated it was a course of conduct. Now, at trial, will my adversary be able to ask her about what could be perceived as an inconsistent statement when she said she perceived it as a question? Yes. But again, we're entitled to the benefit of all reasonable inferences. And if her testimony seems to potentially be inconsistent, I would submit that she's entitled to that inference.
But there's the course of conduct that she's talking about is the inquiry. That's all there is. There's no, she didn't have any information he was sneaking things on the fax or having communications to try to get this job done that he was told he couldn't do. All she has is the inquiry, and she confirmed that. Now, I understand she later said that's a course of conduct, but the fact is that in terms of evidence, it's what he said to her on those two occasions, which were questions.
I agree, except I don't see them as questions given the totality of the circumstances, Justice. I disagree with you there, respectfully.
She has to have a reasonable belief, correct? Her belief, her conclusion that she's being told to do something, or it has to be a reasonable belief that she's being asked to do something that shouldn't be done, that was illegal in this case. Correct?
Absolutely, Justice.
Is that argument, is the argument that if the question of whether she had a reasonable belief, a jury could conclude she had a reasonable belief, undermined by the fact that Kate Barton Skatcher got the contract and she recommended Kate Barton. Does that, in other words, if we're going to say a jury could conclude that she had a reasonable belief that she was being asked to do something illegal, is that in any way undermined by the fact that Kate Barton got the contract partly on her recommendation?
No, and here's why, Justice, because at the time, when you're going to look at a reasonable belief, you got to look at the time. So when she's objecting, she doesn't know what the outcome's going to be.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that. I'm asking, does it undermine her contention that it's a reasonable belief? Because she then comes along, she's got this reasonable belief that she's been threatened, I better do this, it's illegal. And then she says, no, they're the best firm.
No, I don't think it does, because she didn't know they were the best at the time she's objecting. I think it does come in as evidence as to whether or not there's causation. And the county could say, well, why would we have fired her for this? Because ultimately she agreed and the vendor that Mr. Lindsay thought was the best was hired. So that could be evidence that a jury...
And that should be the jury's determination.
Absolutely, Justice.
So I know you asked for 15 minutes for argument, and we're beyond that at this point. I'm looking at the clock and asking my colleagues, do they have more questions?
No
No.
Is there anything you'd like to add at this time, Mr. Iono?
Very briefly, Chief Justice. I just wanted to talk about causation because that's why the case went up to the appellate division. I just wanted to point out a couple of quick facts. I believe, and we believe, that the familial relationship here is important, especially since Mr. Lindsay was brought on while Mr. Thornton was freeholder and freeholder director. I also think it's important, if we look at the time frame, Mr. Thornton indicated that he thought about getting rid of my client about 5 to 6 months before she was non-renewed. And that's the exact time frame when she engaged in the first whistleblowing. The first whistleblowing would have occurred towards the end of February. The non-renewal occurs about 5 months later into July. And what also makes no sense, if that was true, if that's what Mr. Thornton was thinking, then why did the county spend $1,500 to send my client to training in May 2014, 2 months before she was fired? There's also no contemporaneous documentation, bad reviews, bad performance evaluations, written complaints that were submitted by anybody. This is Cape May County and the freeholder director. If they wanted to fire someone for a legitimate reason, one would expect to see contemporaneous documentation and complaints about my client. Now, there was some testimony about that, and I would submit that it was vague, but that's one of the factors that this court can look into, the fact that there wasn't any contemporaneous documentation. There's no negative reviews. You also have testimony from county counsel and assistant county counsel. I think Ms. Bakley Marino said that my client did an excellent job as the purchasing agent, and former associate county counsel, Mr. Arsenal, said that my client knew the law and the statutes and her analysis was spot on. So there's definitely a dispute as to the quality of her performance, given that testimony. And also one other thing I wanted to mention, counsel in the county's argument mentioned that there wasn't evidence that Mr. Thornton was aware of the whistleblowing. We believe his testimony that he read the report is sufficient, but I think this court in Maimone versus the City of Atlantic City held that even though Chief Snellbaker in that case may not have known, or the plaintiff couldn't show that he absolutely knew about the whistleblowing, wasn't fatal to that case. And unless there's other questions, I don't have anything else, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Iono. Ms. Barr, for rebuttal, respectfully, I'm going to stop it after 5 minutes, wherever we might be. Please go ahead. You have to unmute. Please unmute.
There we go. Okay, sorry about that. And I will be brief. The very, very last point that Mr. Iono was discussing as far as what other evidence is in the record, I'm just going to rest on our briefs. I mean, we thoroughly showed that there were performance issues that were maybe not related to or maybe not relayed to plaintiff, but they were there. And there's no question that even she doesn't need to know of her performance issues for it to become a motivating factor in not renewing a contract for an at-will employee. But what I'd like to say is that there are a lot of gaps in this argument, a plaintiff's argument, and gaps that if this did go to the jury would have to fill in by speculation and conjecture, not on the evidence, because this evidence does not support a SEPA claim. It starts with an innocuous event, somebody asking a question of the person whose job is to know the answer, and it kind of just spirals from there. And as far as causation, that happened in February. That issue with the workers' comp coverage had been resolved long before she ever interviewed with or had the interview with Ballard Spahr. So there's a gap in that. You know, why was she still thinking about that long after the workers' comp issue had been resolved? So there's too many gaps in her claim to take this whistleblowing matter to a jury. And that's what a summary judgment motion is for. It's to weed out cases where the evidence is just not there, And that is definitely what is happening here. She doesn't have the evidence to support her ultimate burden of proof for a ZIPA claim. And therefore, we are asking for the trial court's order to be reinstated, granting summary judgment in our favor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.